Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Daily Friend writer and commentator Jonathan Katzenellenberger. Jonathan, how are you?
Good. Thanks, Nick.
Excellent. And IRR project manager Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Nick, and yourself?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. So let me start off with some housekeeping, and that's the exciting news that, as you may have seen on social media, the IRR is going to be partnering with Cliff Central to bring you the Daily Friend Show every Monday to Thursday at 4:30 until 5:00, starting on Monday. So the Friday show will be eliminated, but we will have an extra Tuesday show and a Thursday show for you to listen to. So we're very excited about that, and we look forward to bringing you the news, analysis, and all that good stuff that you listen to us for more regularly. Right, so let's get started. And that is, we've heard for a while now that there is this rumor that the ANC is considering synchronizing local government and national elections and postponing the local government elections for next year to coincide with the local government elections. This would require them to change the constitution probably in parliament, but the EFF has also expressed some support for this idea, and together the two parties have a constitutional changing mandate. Now, what's interesting is that former President Thabo Mbeki has come out and attacked the plan for synchronizing the election. He says that, and this is a quote from a newsletter he sent out the other day, "This would entrench processes according to which practically local government would not be given the special focus it needs. Necessarily, this would legalize the counterproductive neglect which the ANC itself has visited on local government for two decades." Now, that's quite a strong statement coming from the former president, who has been generally pretty soft on his own party since his fall from grace. Terence, should we be very concerned about this possible postponement of local government elections next year?
Yes, I think we should. I think that the precedent it would set is a dreadful one. Changing the constitution to disrupt the course of democratic governance, and one of the key opportunities for accountability, even if South Africans perhaps don't use this as they should. I can see nothing good coming out of this. And I mean, you know, how far do we sort of postpone it for, and do we simply allow governments to continue as they are? I mean, the next election is scheduled for 2024. So if we did that, that's a 3-year delay. And I think Mbeki is quite correct, at least in theory. Local government is a particular species of government and should be treated separately. In fact, I think that one of the big psychological breakthroughs this country needs is to disentangle the governance of communities from the governance of the country, the one of which is a far more party political matter. Communities, I think, need to learn, and it's difficult to sort of interact with themselves in the interests of their own immediate living conditions and what makes them possible. And I think this would simply lead to party politics swamping that conversation even more than it does at the moment. So I think it would entrench a bad situation.
Jonathan, you have some concerns that this would particularly negatively affect the opposition parties.
Well, I think it would, because the ANC is very strong at national level. In an off-year election, which is the municipal election, opposition parties tend to do better, partially because the turnout isn't as large, and that people often feel more motivated if they are opposition if they do support the opposition, to come to the polls on the election day, on the municipal elections. But I think Mbeki makes a very strong point, and that the ANC's motivation for delaying the local government elections and making them part of one bigger super election delayed is that they are running scared at local level, all the municipalities they run are a complete mess across the country. There are very few ANC-run municipalities which have managed to get clean audits. It's been very, very difficult. Most of the overwhelming number of municipalities that are well-run, i.e. get clean audits, a clean audit alone doesn't indicate that they're necessarily well-run, but it does on the whole, are DA in the Western Cape. And I think that what people would tend to do at a when they go into the polls is just look for an ANC, the ANC logo, and just go and just tick next to that. I think that's a dangerous precedent, and particularly at this juncture where municipal government is a real, real mess.
So, of course, one of the problems here is that it removes another opportunity for South Africans to have a say on how things are going and to hold the government to account. A lot of South Africans will talk about how the government only appears in the months before the election to roll out some sort of infrastructure project or jobs program and then disappears. So at the very least, reducing the number of elections would reduce the instances where government appears before an election to hand out goodies. The other problem, though, is I think that a lot of our social disorder, especially before elections, is linked to ANC internal party politics. So what do I mean by that? I mean that ANC candidates who are spurned by the party and pushed out by the internal processes often will take to the streets or encourage service delivery protests against the government to try and get the party to reverse its decision and appoint them as the candidate for a safe ward or something as a councillor. And that if suddenly we have a period now where everyone's going to get an additional 3 years, I suspect that a lot of people who maybe lost out last time on the party's internal politics are going to be very upset that they're going to have to wait an additional 3 years before they can access that patronage. And they're probably going to cause social disorder. Do you think that's a legitimate concern, Terence, or do you think that that's a bit overblown?
Well, I think that, whenever we say something is overblown in South Africa, 2 weeks later, we discover that actually it was, we'd underestimated it. I have heard this repeatedly since the 1990s, that there is a certain predilection in our politics for the for a political post to be seen as a as entitlement, if you will, as something that that one person has a turn at. Supposedly, this is a major issue with continuity in local government, that people who do develop a certain degree of expertise get pushed out because now it's someone else's turn. And I think yes, delaying it would not be well received by many people who were expecting their turn, particularly under circumstances as they exist now. At the best of times, a councillor's position could be the difference between living in a sort of middle class lifestyle and falling into poverty. And now that the our economy has been buried under a slew of COVID and lockdown damage, that position I think will be a great deal more coveted.
So, Jonathan, my question to you is this, and it's about Mbeki. He's been increasingly distant from the ANC over the years, and he's been a little bit more critical of the government. This is a pretty, this line here about how, which the ANC hasn't visited it on local government for two decades, the maladministration that he's talking about here. Do you think Mbeki still represents a portion of South Africa's, especially black middle class? Does he speak for people still, or do you think he's actually completely been pushed to the fringes? Does him speaking out against the government actually, you think, carry real weight in our politics, or do you think he's a completely spent force?
I think the ANC is a very different animal to what it was under him. There were, if you looked at his cabinet, there are very I can only think of one person who was in the Mbeki cabinet, and that's Tito Mboweni. There might have been a few others, but that element in the ANC is really completely gone. It's now, I think, the factions are far more dominant, and I think what you might generally call the Zuma radical economic transformation faction is one faction, and then there's small Ramaphosa type faction that gravitates to where the power is, and they seem to be vying for the soul of the party. But there's very little of the sort of pragmatic, for the most part, Mbeki type. For want of a better word, call it semi-technocratic type views in the ANC to be held. I just don't think that that exists anymore. And I don't think that Mboweni is a bit of an outsider in the current party struggle within the ANC. I think that President Ramaphosa, who goes for consensus, is having to try and find consensus between Mboweni on the one hand and the Radical Economic Transformation faction on the other. And it just doesn't exist on some of the key issues.
And in the population at large, outside of the ANC, do you think he speaks for anyone in particular?
I think he still has a following. I don't know if he actually speaks for anyone. He's kept a pretty low profile. For the most part, we haven't heard much of him. We heard a bit of him. Of course, he was silenced during the Zuma era. They wouldn't allow him to appear on the SABC. And recently, he hasn't really said much. So I suppose when he does speak and raises very legitimate points, one should really listen to him. I think South Africans do listen to elder statesmen, and he definitely has that role today. So, you know, he will be listened to. Whether he has influence in the party is another matter, but he certainly will be listened to.
All right, let's move on to our next topic now, and that is an article that Terence has had published in the Daily Print today, which is entitled "Business Must Find Its Voice." Terence, what were you getting at here, and what would you suggest?
I think Trevor Manuel put it very well a couple of years ago that business are cowards, and I think that actually one of our colleagues said at some point in the past that South African business has seldom found a president didn't like, or a government didn't like. My immediate impetus was something said by some people in the real estate industry is about how these wonderfully low interest rates, this is the time to jump in. And someone said, well, if you have a secure income, that's a big if these days. That was, you know, it seemed to be treating South Africa as though it's a stable, forward moving, developing country that's, run into some temporary difficulties, encouraging one's potential clients to sink their money into something like this is well and good. But do these business people, take any responsibility for the drift of policy, which is hostile towards policy rights, property rights at present, expropriation without compensation? Are they just assuming that somehow this really won't turn out to be that bad, and maybe it'll be someone else's problem? What motivated me to write this is I've been critical of business for sitting on the sidelines and saying alles al rechtkom, although they often forget that the full quote is alles al rechtkom as elk een sy plig doen, and I'm not seeing business doing its plig, but I've seen this coming out of real estate people quite regularly. Oh no, don't worry. This is all about farms. Don't worry. We don't have. This isn't going to affect you. Well, you know, famous last words. What are you doing to make sure it doesn't affect your clients? Or do we do as one financier said on Twitter? Well, you know, if your stuff gets taken, you'll still have to pay, of course. But you know, we don't think it's going to come to that. So you know, do we encourage people to place themselves in a vulnerable position and then wash our hands and walk off? I don't think that's good enough. I think one thing we should have learned from the Zuma era is that business has an interest in positive outcomes. We've seen the same thing elsewhere in the world, in Venezuela, and South Africa pioneered the whole corporate governance approach that said that it's not good enough to just satisfy your shareholders. You know, people, profit, planet. Here's an opportunity. These captains of industry who say that you're coming in the water is great. You know, need to make sure there's no crocodiles, or at least to make some effort at that. This three monkeys approach, I can't see you, can't hear you. It's not good enough. A business needs to find its voice, but there's another part of its anatomy it probably needs to find too.
So, Jonathan, there's obviously some financial reasons why business might not want to criticize government. Some of it is due to, you know, fear of losing out on potential government business. Some of it is fear of the government criticizing them and sort of whipping up popular sentiment against them. But do you think some of it is also driven by, I saw Gareth von Onsland recently wrote about how accusations of Afro-pessimism were used to bash anyone who was critical of the government in the early years of the ANC's government. Do you think that kind of rhetorical, as our colleague Gabriel would say, esteem-based attacks are a big part of why business is so scared to criticize government?
I think actually business is, because of the talk of EWC, the disastrous finances of government, the widening deficits and the poor economic performance, business might be finding its voice. Now, I'm talking here of organized business. Busi Mavuso, who is the head of Business Leadership South Africa, is the most strident head of Business Leadership South Africa that we've ever had. And I would even go back to the days of apartheid, where for the most part they were silent and scared. You know, towards the they did make a few moves and they did warn governments and did try to influence the government, but for the most part they were pretty silent bunch. And it's been very refreshing to hear what she says in her weekly column. I think business are scared. You know, they don't want to in any way be seen as the enemy, you know, because they could easily be seen as the enemy as capitalism. And here we have the government claiming its mandate from the people. But in recent weeks, one has had a plan from Business for South Africa, which brings together all the organized entities of business in this country. And it's been very critical, and it's called for reform. Now, its call for reform is not scrap EWC, let's have privatization. Let's take on labor. It's more carefully couched than that, but we know where it's heading. So I think with the recent crisis, things have changed, but it's all still couched in let's have consensus type terms. And I think business is just very, very worried. There's if you really want to look at an indicator of business sentiment and what it's really saying, look no further than the Business Confidence Index, which is at its lowest point ever. So the real message, I think, must be taken from what business is saying through the business confidence index. But business forever in this country has felt it has to suck up to government. I think, you know, the big corporate CEOs, for the most part, are not chosen for their creativity, willingness to take on government. They're, you know, basically yes men and corporate types. That's what they're chosen for. And that's what I think the sort of economy is to a large extent based on. You know, the entrepreneurs are very different. One exception to this, and a very interesting exception to the corporate yes men on the whole in organized business, is Neil Froneman. And he has been very strident in giving government the real story of why the mining sector is very, very concerned about changing goalposts and policy uncertainty. So I think, you know, just to say that I think Busi Mavuso is a breath of fresh air, and Neil Froneman is a breath of fresh air. I think Martin Kingston has also done good work, but the message, I think, is often lost in the cautious terms in which they speak to government.
Yeah, you know, I will say that I have written a few pieces very complimentary of Ms. Mavuso. In fact, you know, she's been willing to put her her opinions out in quite unambiguous and strident language. Question is, you know, where are the others? You know, and as I say, when I see a group of titans in the property industry saying everything's great and this is your opportunity, yeah, you know, I have to raise my eyebrows.
I do think it's quite extraordinary that I think you're right, but I think that the property industry guys and the banks, it's absolutely extraordinary that they've not come out in strident terms and condemned EWC. You know, not only, oh, we must have property defense of property rights and we want policy certainty, but it's also it's throwing their clients really under the bus. You know, us as big guys, we won't take the hit. You'll still have to pay your mortgages, even if your property and your farm loans, even if your property is taken away from you. You know, I think that not to come out and speak in no uncertain terms is really a dereliction of duty. You know, get some back.
No, absolutely.
You know.
So I believe that the
guys,
real.
I'm under the impression these guys don't know how to play the political game. They don't want to, and they don't know how.
Yeah, that's.
Most of them are just accountants, you know, and without much imagination. They just don't know how to play the game.
I think that's definitely true. And until business actually is able to find those strident words, by and large, you know, as long as it's couched in terms of policy certainty and consensus, government is not really going to feel that pressure. Now, in our last couple of minutes here, let's just move on very briefly to Jonathan. You wanted to speak about some of the consequences of the IMF COVID relief fund. So we've heard news that the IMF is going to be giving us a lot of money, which the IRR has been running a campaign around, which you can check out Tuesday's Daily Friend for some info about. But Jonathan, what are your thoughts on the IMF relief fund?
Well, I think it's what is significant about it's not a relief fund, really. It's an emergency loan, 70 billion rand, $4.2 billion. It's significant that they went for the loan. They could have gone without the loan, but they would have found that it's very difficult to borrow that sort of amount of money and would have put upward pressure on the rates at which South Africa borrows. You know, you're paying 1% for 3-year money and they would have paid far, far more for that money from the markets. South Africa is in an unusual position. It doesn't really need foreign exchange, as we have enormous foreign exchange reserves, and we don't really face a balance of payments crisis. But what is significant about the loan is the letter of intent written by from the Minister of Finance and the Governor of the Reserve Bank. And I think, one, it's very positive. And if one looks to that, you know, one thinks South Africa is going to reform big time. It's got all the reforms, the structural reforms that certainly I've been talking about in my columns for some time, and that the IMF has, and private economists in this country. Government says, you know, we're going to come in with product and market reforms. There's going to be labor reform and all the things that have been on the agenda for the past 20 years. And on this, and it's all very positive. And so they're on the line on this. There are no consequences for not doing it, because it's a low conditional facility, and it's dispersed all at once. And there's also and I thought very clever, they've got to be, one of the conditions is that they're going to be transparent on the disbursement of the on COVID-19 related payments. So that is very significant. And if one can get transparency on this into the contract, one will see where all the problems have arisen. And I see that a number of high-profile ANC figures in government have had to take temporary leave because of an investigation into their relationship to people who've gained these personal protective equipment contracts. So it's I think it's very positive.
Terence, do you have any final thoughts on this topic before we close for today?
I think there was a piece in the Daily Maverick that said something about this loan doesn't come with many strings, the next one will. This is not the last time we've seen Uncle IMF.
Yeah, I think that is the case. I think taking out this loan possibly shifts a lot of the storm to the side. But, you know, they're on the line now on structural reform. They're going to have to do it. Here they've stated it. And I think that the quicker it's done, and instead of this endless search for consensus with Labour, which you're not going to achieve, it'll be the better. If they don't get on with it, it's going to be derailed. And just because you take out a high conditional an IMF loan with lots of conditions doesn't mean you can meet the conditions and it's all set. I've seen many IMF programs derail. They get one tranche, they can't implement, they get another, and it goes on for years and years and years.
All right. Thank you, Terence and Jonathan. I think we're going to call it to a close for today. I'd like to thank, though, every single one of the friends of the Institute of Race Relations for your support and your help in getting us to be the independent voice that we are, to be able to host Daily Friend Show, to be able to do the research and policy analysis that we do. Thank you especially to those of you who have become friends to support our IMF campaign. We think that that's that's been a very influential thing about the country. As we say, now the government is really under pressure to do structural reform, and you're making a real difference by supporting us. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We will see you on the Monday edition, and have a lovely weekend, everyone. Cheers.